The power of crystals. Power crystals, as Dr. John DeSalvo calls it. We'll be back with that in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we're with Dr. John DeSalvo. John, let's talk about the power of meditation with these crystals, how it works, and how you do it.
Okay, good question. I first actually started meditating back in the 70s, and one of the first classes I took was Transcendental Meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I still do it to this day. I find it very, very beneficial. And again, I've had my you know, biofeedback, my body physiological variables measured when I've done TM and know what changes occur. Now, when I wrote my books on magic, Enochian magic, I noticed I was getting into a deep, altered meditative state. And what was interesting was, even after 30 years of doing TM, the first time I went into the Enochian magic state, it seemed like a deeper state. Again, I couldn't quantitatively identify because I have never been measured doing the Enochian meditation, which I developed, only the other types of meditation, some other Eastern meditations too. But just my subjective responses showed it was a much deeper effect. That's why I like the Enochian meditation that I propose in my last book. So that's where I decide, I guess because of Lon Milo Duquette's suggestion, using quartz crystals in my magical meditation. But I realized that everybody wants to do a magical meditation because they're, you know, it's uncharted territory and people are kind of maybe nervous about that. But meditation people are a little bit more comfortable with. So kind of how I arrived at putting a chapter in on this in the book and explaining it was that I think meditation is important for everyone. It's a spiritual technique. It helps us get in touch with ourselves. I believe it helps us get in touch with God and the angels and higher spiritual realms. So people have claimed crystals have helped them doing this for, you know, for eons. And I put a chapter in on meditation. Actually, Helene Olson wrote the section up on it based on what the angels told her the best way to meditate with crystals. And it's really interesting because I do believe meditation is a personal procedure or technique. There are many different types of meditation. What would work for you, George, may not work for me.
Okay.
And also the other thing is what would work for you today may not work for you tomorrow and vice versa.
But it does work. You're convinced of that.
I can't prove it scientifically, only subjectively. And yes, I'm 100% sure in my own experience that meditating with crystals helps. Now, I have to say, you know, there's everything has a good and a bad. There's a yin and a yang, you know, white and black. Meditating with crystals could have its inherent dangers because, like I said, it could act as a magnifying glass and bring out things from your subconscious too quickly that you may not want to have to deal with in one shot. So, like in anything, use moderation and use your judgment. And I also, you know, this may sound funny, but I also advise using spiritual protection even when you do meditation with crystals. And the reason why, I mean, I always suggest protection when you do magical rituals, but I knew some ghost hunters years ago, and they always said whenever we go on a ghost hunting expedition, we always use magical protection when we begin and when we end because they're afraid of carrying entities back with them and opening themselves up. And I didn't realize that. You never hear about that, that maybe not all ghost hunting people do that. But just in my experience, in general, you know, I think it's always good, whether it's a white light visualization technique or something known as the lesser banishing ritual of the pentagram, which is, by the way, the most powerful protection and cleansing technique. It's so old, we don't even know where it originated. It takes like a couple minutes or less to do. And so I always advise whether you're going to do meditation with crystals or magical rituals or even ghost hunting or you buy an object from an antique store and you're not sure about its energy, you know, do some kind of a protection on it or, you know, purification ceremony. And it could be as simple as holding the object in your hand, you know, dousing it with sage and saying a few prayers. Now, one thing to keep in mind is I believe certain objects have more powerful energies than others. So certain objects may need more powerful, you know, protection or purification processes than others. So if one doesn't, in my book, I give like about, I think, three different kinds of white light, burying it in sage, dousing it in sage. You can bury crystals in the ground. I just want to mention this because I think, like in any kind of occult or psychic technique, we're really in unknown territory. And I think we have to be careful. Just because our intentions are good doesn't mean we won't get any harm from it. I could have the best of intentions, but if I stick my finger in an electrical outlet, I'm going to get electrocuted. So I think it's always good to be safe. If you're not sure of the technique's right for you, then don't do it. I mean, only do it if you feel it's something that it's right for you.
Sure.
You know, you're a sound mind and, you know, no physical or I don't say any kind of outstanding psychological problems, because you're really opening up unknown territories. I hope that's, you know, a good advice.
John, Edgar Cayce, in some of his readings, would always recommend that people have a little piece of metal in their pocket, and because he felt it drew the powers of the universe to you. And it's a special piece of metal, I guess. It could be iron, could be lead, I'm not sure. What's the special use of crystals? I mean, do you recommend people carry them on their bodies or what?
I personally don't. I mean, I think it's up to the individual. I mean, I wear a reliquary sometimes. Actually, it's a, you're going to love this, George. It's actually a piece of the bloody glove from Padre Pia, you know, the stigmata.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it has an extremely high energy. All my psychics who've seen that, I never told them what it was. But what is this? This is just emanating incredible energy. I don't wear it all the time. It's a matter of taste, religious belief, and preferences. So some people I know do carry sometimes little crystals or small crystal skulls. Remember Joe Parr, the late Joe Parr?
Oh, sure.
Was, again, the greatest pyramid researcher. Oh, by the way, I was interviewed for a couple episodes of Ancient Aliens, and they haven't been scheduled yet, but one of them I'll be talking about Joe Parr's work.
Good. So that's that'll go on the high definition channel.
I hope so,
H2.
Now, the interesting thing about that, Joe, to the day he died, when he slept on top of the Great Pyramid, remember, for two nights, one in 77 and one, I think, in 78, he chipped off two pieces from the top of the Great Pyramid, and he kept one in his shirt pocket for 30 years to the day he died. And the other piece he gave to me, which I cherish, obviously. And so some people may carry, you know, an artifact or a rosary or a crucifix or, a crystal skull. I wouldn't want to carry my 7-pound crystal skull around with me.
But... No.
And I think that's good. You know, I would like to say one thing about religious artifacts. I believe they're good if they point us towards God. They're pointers. They're not something that we need to idolize or worship or get stuck with. And so if meditating with crystals or magic or saying a rosary or going to church brings us to God, that's good. They're just pointers. We don't want to worship the pointer. So don't get attached to, you know, if you have a crystal you've had all your life and you break it, don't worry about it. It was a pointer. Maybe it was time to move on to a different pointer.
Now, what are you concluding by some of your research, John?
Well, I guess if I could talk a little bit about the scientific studies on the small crystal skull, which I did, because that has been subject to the most intense scientific studies. And as I mentioned, at this point, most of the famous crystal skulls that were studied using the techniques that I'm going to be talking about have been shown to be modern productions. Several of them, like Shana Ra and Max, haven't been tested, or if they have, the results weren't released, and two were unknown. But I have done more scientific studies on my small crystal skull than any other crystal skull to date. And what's interesting about it was it is small. It's the size of a baseball, and I think Lex posted it on the website. It could fit into the vacuum chamber of the scanning electron microscope. Now, why that's important is the vacuum chamber is small, so if you have a large skull, you have to take molds and then look at them. But because you can fit it underneath, you can look at it in real time, and you can scan it. And when you see an area of interest, you can magnify it. And if you want to reposition the crystal, though, you got to open the vacuum chamber and reposition it. Because, see, an electron microscope uses a beam of electrons, and air molecules would interfere with it. So I brought my crystal skull to the University of Minnesota Duluth, the scanning electron microscope lab, and I had the manager run with me a series of scans on it. And it was very interesting. We also were able to do a technique known as energy dispersive spectroscopy, which you can only do if you have the actual object in the vacuum chamber. When you're looking at an area, let's say, and there's a particle or something, you want to know what its composition is, you hit it with an X-ray beam, and you get a plot on another screen of the exact atomic composition. Isn't that interesting?
It is.
So, for example, there was a red pigment around the skull that I had, and we didn't know what it was. Could have been iron oxide, could have been cinnabar, because cinnabar is a pigment, a red pigment, that was used to paint funerary objects in China. Very toxic because it's mercury-based. So we were able to study that red pigment with the energy dispersive spectroscopy and found out that it was probably just some kind of hydrocarbon covering. We couldn't determine what it was. It was interesting. A person named Gary Butler, who I credited with the first real scientific studies on these crystal skulls, who passed away at a young age, was a wonderful person. He had a similar crystal skull like mine with a red pigment and brought it to the University, I think, of Utah. And they determined it to be a tree resin covering the skull. So that would be consistent with what I have on mine. I sent a scan to Dr. Jane Michaels. Remember the lady who did the Smithsonian study and showed the Mitchell Hedges skull?
Wasn't real? Yeah.
Yeah, and I asked her what I thought could it be blood, actually, because some of the peaks I thought had some of the composition of elements in blood, which would be kind of freaky, you know. but anyway, she showed it to one of her friends who's an EDS expert and said, no, it just some kind of looks like it was buried in dirt or some kind of types of soil, which would be consistent for the skull being buried for many years. Who knows how many years? But the results of the electron microscope study, I'll give you the bottom line, was that, and I had like four other SEM directors at major universities in the U.S. and Canada study my results. So it wasn't just one person, and I don't think any of the other crystal skull studies ever had did this. It usually was one researcher institute that did it, but I had others look at it. The bottom line is no modern tools or techniques have been identified that could have produced it. No evidence of ion probes, lasers, rotary wheel, modern type of equipment or abrasives. We don't know how it was carved. It looks a primitive method, but it was highly oxidized by a slow oxidation process. It could have either been buried in the soil for very long periods of time or running water for long periods of time. So all I can say is the skull has undergone the most scientific testing of any known crystal skull out there, has not been shown to be modern, but I can't say it's ancient. How do you can't prove that somebody didn't produce it using primitive methods in a modern time. But the idea of the slow acid oxidation and the weathering patterns and the tree resin really kind of, to me, is more circumstantial evidence that this, we're really talking about an ancient crystal skull. And then I also had my five psychometrists look at it also.
Okay, so John, as you look at all this, you had mentioned the work of Richard Schafsky.
Right.
And his research work. Is he still alive?
Oh, yes. He's okay. a very good friend of mine and continues to do work with me. In fact, I interviewed him on my radio show, and he talked in detail about all the findings that... You see, him and Nick Nocerino went to Mexico back in the 70s, and Richard met Francesco Reyes, who was the shaman who brought the Mayan and amethyst crystal skull to the United States. In fact, Richard and Francisco smuggled the Mayan crystal skull into the United States, and then Richard and Nick, while they had possession of it, brought the skull to HP and Bell Labs to do a series of tests on it. And Richard had kept the secret quiet for 20 years. And then when Chris put me in touch with him, this was about a week or two before I was finalizing my book, we were just so wonderful. It was so wonderful to have met Richard. I felt like he was a long-lost brother. He gave me and wrote a section, a whole appendix in my book on the tests done on the Mayan crystal skull and his adventure with Nick in Mexico. It was like an Indiana Jones movie. And Richard is highly psychic also. So Richard believes it's an ancient crystal skull in the order of tens or of thousands of years old. It may have an alien counterpart. What's interesting is most of the psychics felt the energy from the small crystal skull is like a strange energy. It's not something they usually encounter. It has some kind of alien counterpart. Not that it was made by aliens. They believe it was made by humans, possibly under the direction of aliens. But it does give off very high energy from its eyes, and they most of them think it's some kind of transmitter and receiver. Richard feels it has a lot of energy and information in it. Now, don't forget, again, these are the results of psychics. I only take that as one piece of information, one piece of data in context with the scientific data. But it's interesting that the psychometry work done on the small crystal skull and the science is very similar. It kind of matches. It kind of fits together like a glove. And that's what excites me about it, because this could be the closest evidence for this being an authentic ancient crystal skull. But again, I have to say, you know, you can't prove it's ancient. You can just rule out a lot of things about it and show the weathering patterns consistent. Now, could we carbon date the coating? Yes. If it's a tree resin, it's carbon-based. So that's something I was thinking of doing.
But that doesn't tell you when it was made.
No, but it would tell you when it was coated. So let's say the tree resin is 5,000 years old. You could assume maybe the skull was made around that time because it then had
okay.
to be coated.
But if it's only 100 years old, then,
right, well, then
there
you know,
it goes.
Yeah. And I spoke to the director of one of the largest carbon 14 labs in the country about doing that. He had reservations because he felt due to the environmental conditions of the skull and the contaminants, he didn't think the carbon 14 would be a valid test. But my feeling was, what if it came out to be 5,000 years old? You know, that would be another interesting indication, even though realizing it could be subject to contamination. He thought it could make it look a lot younger than it would be, but that's fine. It would just be another piece of data. So I may do that in the future, because as a scientist, I like to look at every possibility. So this was an adventure for me, because the British Museum test, they couldn't do this in real time. They couldn't put the skull in the vacuum chamber. They didn't have an EDS where you have the elemental composition. And I had four other SEM directors look at the data. So it was, again, a unique opportunity. And if somebody says to me, is it ancient? I'll say, I don't know. So far, all the evidence points to it. But, you know, I can't say for sure.
Okay, if it was ancient, tell me the significance of it. If it was very old.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're asking somebody who's not very psychic. No.
Practical you are.
Yeah, well, thank you. I, from what I am told from the psychics, is that there's a tremendous amount of energy in the skull and information
right.
that could be used.
Stored away.
Yeah, I don't know how to do that. I don't know if they do. I would have to probably...
Yeah, how do you extract it?
Yeah, that's the question. And it's maybe it's the same question we have with questions about the Great Pyramid. We know it's something special. It has some special purpose, but we really don't know what it is. There's 1,000 theories out there. There's not really more data in one theory than another. We still don't know. Same with the Shroud. We don't know how the Shroud was made, but we know it's something special, and it's not a modern production. So I think the same thing is with the crystal skull. I think my intuitive feeling is it's some kind of tool for the future, maybe not now, maybe down the road. Maybe there's people that can extract the information. And I always bring my skulls. You know, I speak at a lot of times, symposiums or life expos. I did one in Minneapolis this summer, and I brought my crystal skulls and put them out on display, and the psychics came by. I let them touch them, hold them, do what they want, and I recorded information, and I kind of make it available to everyone. I never charge anybody for looking at my skull or spending time. I just feel it's something there for the world for people to look at.
All right, John, we're going to come back in just a moment and also talk about your work on the Shroud of Turin. Okay, next hour we'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to ask a question or two of John DeSalvo. When we come back in a moment, let's talk about his work on the Shroud of Turin on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, John, before we move on to talk about your work with the Shroud of Turin, have we left anything out on power crystals that you want to talk about?
Well, you're pretty thorough. I guess the one thing I would like to say is that I really looked at this book as a kind of a joint effort of just many, many contributors. And I think that's why it's so successful and people like it. You know, it's just not my work. It's, having Joanne Parks write the foreword and Richard Chafsky, his experience, my five psychics. There's like, I think, 16 pages of color inserts. Many, many people sent me photos. Michelle Nocerino. I mean, I can go on and on. Lynn Johnson, who's Gary Butler's widow, supplied me with photos. It was a group effort, and I tell you, I got to meet a lot of new people, rekindle a lot of past friendships, and make new friends. And, you know, that's really what it's all about. I want to give some advice to people that want to write a book, too, if you don't mind, because I know I started listening to Coast before I even had a book out. I can blame you and Art, by the way, for me getting into all these fields. You know, I mean, I was just a normal teacher and professor back then. I started listening to Coast, so thank you.
We pulled you in. Okay, Shroud of Turin, what's the latest here?
Well, you know, I knew you were going to ask me that because you always do.
I always do. I'm obsessed with this story.
And me too, actually. I mean, that took, since 1970, it's been part of my life, a major part. So I always call my general projects director the day I'm going on Coast to Coast and say, Paul Maloney again, who I feel Paul is probably, and Barry Schwartz, two of my closest friends, the most knowledgeable people on the Shroud alive today. Paul, what's anything new since I don't really keep up on it as much as I used to, but basically he said nothing at all. There's a conference coming up, and which is disappointing to me because I think, as I always mentioned to you, I'd like to see the Shroud at least on a permanent display, like the Declaration of Independence is, and have it available for scientific studies, even non-destructive tests. But that's not happening, and it's disappointing. At least it's being preserved, and I wish I could have information for you about it. But all I can say is I still think that the definitive answer is out yet. I personally believe the evidence points strongly to it being authentic, circumstantial evidence. Nothing has ever been shown that it could be a production by painting or I heard every variation, the Camera Obscura by Da Vinci and on. None of it fits the data we have on the Shroud. So how is it produced? Nobody really knows. There's 100,000 theories out, but like the pyramids, and we don't know how it was produced. But that makes it exciting, and I do believe it's a very spiritual object. I believe it's a wonderful object for devotion, and I hope it is preserved, but I hope it undergoes some study. I found out something very interesting about my first book on the Shroud, if you want to hear about that.
Yeah, please.
Well, you know, must have been over 30 years ago, I co-authored a book with Frank Adams on the Shroud, which is called Sindon, a Layman's Guide to the Shroud of Turin. It's out of print. It never was a big seller, but it was a fun book. It was my first, actually my first and only book, I guess, on the Shroud. Several years ago, a friend of mine wrote to me and said, did you know Elvis died with that book in his hand? And I said, Elvis who? What are you talking about? And supposedly, Frank Adams had written a book before he co-authored this book with me, which I guess my book, he incorporated all that information into our books. I guess it was like a prototype book. That was the last book that Elvis read before he died. He had that book in his hand by Frank Adams, a prototype of the book that we did together. So Elvis supposedly, I guess during this last part time of his life, was getting really interested into spiritual matters and was asking for people to bring him books on different spiritual topics, which is interesting.
It is interesting.
I think that's the urge we all have. I always say we're all searching for God or who we are or why are we here. We may not know that, and that's the problem. Many of us think we sublimate the search into we want the best car, and we keep buying bigger and bigger and more expensive cars, and we're never happy, or the bigger house, or the better spouse, or the whatever. We try to get the most important thing is we think it's a material object, but what it is it's our urge to find God. And that's why we're never happy with material possessions or wealth or fame or power. I mean, maybe some people think they are, but I feel that the urge is to find God. And no matter where we are in life, once we identify that that is the urge, we will embark on a spiritual search. And all these things, all these topics you have on Coast, all the topics I investigate, everything I've done has a spiritual aspect of it. We're trying to find answers because that's the most important question to ask. And I encourage people to ask that question and investigate. But again, use logic, reason, scientific judgment. Don't go off on a tangent. Base your beliefs on facts that can be proven, or at least facts that seem reasonable. And you can temper intuition with science.
Is it also the search to find out who we are, John?
Yeah, I think so. You remember the first Star Trek movie that nobody liked? I loved it, where that satellite was given a whole kind of spacecraft by this alien intelligence to find out who his creator was, mm-hmm. or who he was. Yeah, that's when you think about it, all of a sudden you're in your mind, and it's just you. There's nobody else. And you kind of think, all of a sudden I'm here. Why am I here? What's my purpose? It's got to be more than getting up on a daily basis, doing a job and coming home, eating and carrying out normal routines. I mean, yeah, we have to do that to survive. But there's that hidden drive within us that we really want to know who we are.
Absolutely.
And I believe we can get answers. We may not get the final answer in this lifetime, whether it's reincarnation, we go into another dimension, into heaven. Nobody knows. I always say everybody thinks they have the answer what happens when we die, but nobody really knows. If somebody knew what the truth was, we'd all be in that religion. You know? So, but I think that I personally believe there is a God. I base my whole life on searching for this God. It is a good and a loving God. I believe we have part of God in us, and when we die, that part continues to exist as a separate entity, as a separate person. And there's a purpose behind this, and there's a spiritual path. The rest to me is footnotes. I don't know. I mean, those are kind of what I base my faith in, and it allows me to be flexible and change when different information comes my way.
If the shroud is authentic,
yeah,
what does that tell you? What's the bottom line here, if it's authentic?
Well, I think there's a lot of different bottom lines. One is that for spiritual people that believe in the point that Jesus was Son of God, incarnation of God, a cosmic Christ, many different ways of describing him, that may be evidence or a symbol left by him to let people know who he was. The other possibility is maybe we're going to decode something from it that could be important for us today, maybe some spiritual messages. And third, maybe individual faith. Maybe it boils down to what we each individually believe and what we can take from a spiritual object like the shroud. It could be great encouragement for many. I do believe there's many paths to God as souls in the world, so I don't think the shroud is going to make everyone Catholic or Christian or this or that, but I think it will point towards God and say, this is our purpose in life, to discover the God within us and to love God and to love our fellow human being. So I think, yes, I think it could be an important spiritual tool for all humanity. And if not, you know, we did our best to scientifically study it. Like I said, what the truth is, it still hasn't been determined 100%, but at this point, I haven't seen any evidence to contradict that it's not an authentic burial cloth and most likely the burial cloth of Jesus Christ.
Well, and if it's not authentic, it doesn't do that much. It doesn't destroy belief, does it?
No. You see, that's the thing. Like I said, these are pointers towards God. So if the pointer turns out to be a wrong pointer, that doesn't invalidate the goal that you're going to. So see, this is one of the problems. People get into a certain religion or a belief, and then they lose faith in it, or they find out that it was a fake religion. They lose belief in God, but it was just a pointer that turned out to be wrong. Find a pointer that helps you. And again, your pointer may be different than mine. That's why I don't believe in converting anyone or try to convince anyone to believe what I believe, because we are all individual souls. We're individual physical beings, mental beings, and spiritual beings, and we are different at different times in our life. I remember when I was on your show many, many years ago, and I was talking about Andrew Jackson Davis. And I said that my favorite quote of Andrew Jackson Davis, the clairvoyant from the 19th century, was, he said, "Don't expect me to believe today what I believed yesterday, and don't expect me to believe tomorrow what I believe today, but I expect to make progress every 24 hours or change." And I think that's the case. So something that's important and helpful for your spiritual path today may not have been helpful years ago. Notice synchronicity. Sometimes things come into your life that you get a benefit spiritually from that you say, you know, if this came into my life 5 years ago, it wouldn't have had any effect. I would have ignored it.
That's right. Now, is there anything that can be done to convince us that the shroud beyond any shadow of a doubt is real?
Not to my knowledge. I mean, unless some kind of supernatural effect is found within it, you know, whether...
No technology on the horizon, anything like that?
You know, it could be. I'm learning, just never say never, because we never know what's going to be discovered. We don't know what kind of technology could be evolved. What if we developed a time machine where we could put an object in, like psychometry, and get a visual picture of where it's been? I mean, just one, and then you could maybe see Jesus, and he could even be talking to us in real time. I mean, this is science fiction, but how much science fiction is reality today?
Or a hologram.
Exactly. I mean, wouldn't that be interesting? Like in Star Wars, you hit the shroud with certain lasers, and all of a sudden, you know, a 3D hologram pops up. I mean, I know a lot of people are probably laughing at this, but again, as I said,
it's all possible.
When I started my undergraduate school and I was doing programming with the IBM 360, if you told me what the technology would be today, I'd say that's beyond science fiction. You know, you're crazy. We'll never get to that level. So we're not going to close the patent office yet. Remember that guy in the 1800s said we're going to close the patent office because everything that is going to be invented has already been invented.
Yeah. So what does your gut tell you about the shroud?
My gut tells me it's authentic. And the reason is I have never seen any artifact in the history of mankind.
It's not done by Da Vinci, right?
No. I mean, I can rule that out right away because Da Vinci lived 1450s to 1520. We can document the shroud back to 1357, 100 years before he was born. In fact, not recently, not in the last 10 years, the Hungarian Prey manuscript surfaced, which shows pictures or drawings of the shroud from the 12th century, which definitely matches the shroud. It couldn't have been a coincidence. So we're talking about something that we are pretty sure historically existed back to the 11th century, and Da Vinci wasn't born until the 1450s. So, I mean, unless he got a piece of linen cloth, you know, that was 500 years old, and then, and by the way, the camera obscura and his technique, how do you explain the blood image going, the blood going on the shroud first and then the image, because there's no image under the blood. It's a surface phenomena. There's no chemical compositions that a camera obscura would need to do to produce the image on the shroud. I mean, I can go on and on. There's a list. Reason I know a lot of these, this is a question I'm usually asked the most when people ask me, what about Da Vinci? And I said, oh, my God, you can just, one of the easiest things to rule out. But that's the problem. There's so many theories, but nothing fits all the data. You have to have a process that produces remember, the shroud is just images on the surface. It's like only a couple fibrils into the shroud, thousandths of an inch on the surface. We don't know how it was produced. The blood went on first, and then the image was produced. How do you do that? How do you put on the blood stains and then paint an image around it? It's a 3D reproduction. We can use a VP8 image analyzer. We produce it in 3D. Many people have seen that. It's a negative. So you cannot get all these characteristics on any known artistic technique or the camera obscura or, you know, whatever technique somebody proposes. So with all the scientific studies, we haven't shown it to be a fake. People, this may sound funny, but you know what? One of the reasons I think it's probably authentic, when I was a college professor back in Pennsylvania, I had a student of mine who was a nurse and was psychic, and he claimed he could, like Casey, he could look and diagnose, but he had to keep his mouth shut or he'd get thrown out of medical school. He was very psychic. I remember when he came over to my house once, I showed him pictures of the shroud. He said, oh, I know this is authentic because I can see two angels, one on each side guarding it, and I know authentic relics have two angels guarding them. That's what I usually say.
I mean, how do we know he wasn't just spouting that?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so we don't know. I mean, so isn't that interesting that we have this object, and what could it mean for humanity? I think The answer to your question, it could be many, mean many, many things.
It'll be huge.
I think so. I think so.
So would Noah's Ark's discovery.
Yeah, I was involved with that, too. You know, I worked with Colonel Jim Irwin, the astronaut.
Oh, yeah. He was obsessed with that.
Oh, yeah, he was a wonderful man. I mean, I remember that exposition where he really got hurt. I spoke to him before he went on.
How many times did he go? A couple times?
Yeah, I think so. But in the last time was when he had the accident, and he was going to try to bring me back a larger sample. Because I have a sample from the Navarre expedition from 1977. I was going to do some studies on it. I never got around to it and kind of lost interest. Now there's that. You heard about the Chinese discovered that supposedly alleged ark.
That's a big story.
I saw the video they produced. Pretty impressive that this thing's authentic.
It's in that region.
Yeah, I'd love to study it, but I mean, the video of it is amazing. The archaeologists are banging on it. It's hollow. They're showing the different segments of it in the wood. And I don't know if they – I think they did some carbon-14. The problem is I don't believe in a universal flood. There's just the physics couldn't explain it, and plus – there's no evidence of it in like the tree ring and tree ring analysis, and no evidence of it. But it could have been a local flood, and that could have been what we're looking at. Noah's Ark could have been a local flood in the Mesopotamian area, and again, another interesting area. There's not a lot of areas that haven't been into, huh, George?
No, not at all. Irwin, by the way, he died of a heart attack, didn't he?
You know, I can't remember.
I think he did back in 91.
I remember
91.
Afterwards his wife, I know, contacted several of us about, he brought some flags to the moon and I think wanted to help distribute those. And that was like 10 years, many years ago. I can't remember. I really didn't keep in touch. But again, wonderful, wonderful man. You know, like us, we get obsessed with some archaeological artifact that has a spiritual importance. And we want to find the answers. And I do believe it's good if you don't have a theory that you put your ego in and you're willing to abandon it when something comes along. And I see that's a problem, not only in academic research, but in metaphysical research. Too many people, their theories are their egos. And when you destroy their theory, they're so resilient and they're so of letting it go because that's them. And so I always say, I really have no theory. I'm just open to anything. And, wherever the science shows, wherever the data lands, that's what I'm willing to accept at the present until more important or more significant data comes along, and then I'll either modify or abandon my theory.
Here's a trivia question. Of all the astronauts that have walked on the moon, how many are dead now?
Oh, my God. I don't know. How many?
12.
Really?
That's a lot. I mean,
that is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, George, I know you and I have so many similar interests, but we grew up in the space program. Remember when the Sputnik went up? Boy, the scare that was.
I was 7 years old when that happened, and I couldn't understand why everybody was panicking, but they were.
I know. And every kid dreamed of being an astronaut, and I couldn't even do 10 pull-ups in school, so I don't even know why I dreamed of being an astronaut.
Can you do 10 pull-ups now? That's the question.
I don't think I can do one. Well, I probably could do one.
All right. Well, you stay with us. The book, Power Crystals, by Dr. John DeSalvo. And we will be back in a moment with your phone calls on crystal skulls and the Shroud of Turin right here on Coast to Coast AM. If you need to email me, that too you can do, George@coasttocoastam.com.